meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. We've got a quorum to conduct business. Let the record reflect that time is currently 9:06 a.m. on Thursday, March 1, 2018. Present today, we have Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, Representative Gren, Representative Thompson, myself, Co-Chair Foster. Before we start, just a reminder, if folks could please mute their cell phones. Today, we'll have six bills before us, time permitting. HB 176, which is ground emergency medical transport payments. HB 301, alcohol licenses, beverage dispensary restaurants. HB 38, workers' compensation death benefits. And it is my intent, if it is the will of the committee, to move those three bills today. And then we will have an introduction and public testimony on HB 168, a repeal of Administrative Regulation Review Committee, together with HCR 10, a resolution that amends the uniform rules. We may also move those if it is also the will of the committee. And our last bill up today is HB 110, which is massage therapy licensing and exemptions. So with that, first bill up today is HB 176, ground emergency medical transport payments by Representative Wolf. And we last heard this bill on February 20th. We closed public testimony and passed two amendments. So with that, Representative Wool and your aide, Mr. Earl, if you could please come to the table, put yourself on the record. And just FYI for the committee, we have available to help answer questions Ms. Margaret Brody, Director of Division of Health Care Services, and online Scott Clough, Principal of AP Triton Consulting. So with that, if you could both put yourselves on the record, and if you've got anything to add, please do so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the Finance Committee. My name is Adam Wool, representative from District 5 in Fairbanks, and with me is
Rob Rule, staff representative Wool.
Is there anything you'd like to add?
The only thing I would add, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, is at the end of the last meeting, there was an outstanding question about this 20% admin fee. And after further consultation with the Department of Health and Social Services, we came to the conclusion that the best way to proceed is to charge whatever fee it the actual cost and process it that way and not try to get into adding a flat rate percentage fee.
Any questions of the committee? Seeing no questions, thank you. Representative Guerra.
Is it possible if you get us a chart with more arrows and smaller print?
Representative Gabber, no problem.
Okay. Thank you. And so with that, maybe let's walk through the fiscal notes. And if we could have Ms. Margaret Brody and Legislative Finance Director David Teal, if you could both come to the table. And if you could put yourselves on the record and walk the committee through the fiscal notes.
David Teal, Director of the Legislative Finance Division.
For the record, I'm Margaret Brody, Director of Healthcare Services.
And I'd just like to note for the record, we're also joined by Representative Pruitt. Please proceed. And Vice Chair Guerra, please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if you have questions or you just want us to walk through the fiscal notes so that perhaps questions are either generated or headed off. Okay. One thing you may notice is that the notes start in FY20. So technically these are zero fiscal notes for FY19. And if you're looking at the fiscal note for medical assistance administration, that's the single page note. I don't know if everyone's found that or whether or there's a code at the bottom. I can read that too if you wish.
What's it, Thompson? The OMB number?
The OMB number is 242. And that note simply shows the administrative costs. those costs are incurred in the Medicaid Assistance Administration. It's noticed from the fund source that it's all interagency receipts. That means the money has to come from somewhere, and that money comes from the other fiscal note, OMB component 2077. So I don't think there should be any question on OMB 242. All it does is say the administrative position that's being created is housed in that allocation, but is paid for with IA receipts coming from somewhere else. So if you turn to OMB component 2077, you'll see the same number on the services line. This is the cash that backs the interagency receipts that go in the other fiscal note. That is also the 116.6, and then dropping slightly, is the small administrative cost associated with the program. I think the more important points are that looking at the fund source, you see it's a $21 million, almost $22 million fiscal note. But it's important to understand that state costs are covered here. The munis, fire departments, et cetera, benefit at no cost to the state. The way they benefit is that as they provide services to Medicaid-eligible people, they turn in a bill, they are reimbursed for a portion of their costs. They can, under this bill, turn in a request for the non-federal share of they give the state the non-federal share of reimbursement, roughly half, but the match rates vary, so depending on who's being transported, but it's roughly half that they will gain. The feds pay the rest, so that the municipalities will pay money to the state. The state will then say to CMS that we have incurred costs. The feds will match that cost, and both the federal and the municipal share will be returned to the municipal fire department. So again, the state doesn't make any money on this. They will cover their administrative costs, which are limited to actual dollars, not some percentage. And the sponsor already noted that, so I won't repeat how that works. But so the state comes out neutral. The municipalities gain the federal match for the unreimbursed share. So everybody should be happy with the feds getting to pay more money for the same services being provided.
Committee, have any questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can either of you walk through the 2020 fiscal year start date and the page 3 of the bill, the conditional effect and the effective date that we're putting in, which are certified as the November 1st, 2018, and then Section 4, if this is enacted, then it takes place. I'm trying to coordinate those fiscal dates with the fiscal months. I mean, the effective dates in Section 3 and Section 4 with the fiscal months. Can you just explain to me how those work so we have it on record?
Thank through the Chair, Representative Seaton. This is going to require a state plan amendment to be submitted to CMS, and that typically takes a little bit of time, anywhere from 60 days and some up to 9 months. This is pretty straightforward, so we believe that the state plan amendment will go through pretty quickly. But we put the effective date out in order for us to get the federal approval prior to implementing the program.
Follow up?
And I'm just trying to follow through with the here, because section 4 on page 3, line 23, says the act takes effect. It takes effect on the day after the date the Commissioner of Health and Social Services makes the certification to the revisor statute under section 2 of the act. And that date under section 2 of the act, or section 3 of the act requires that it takes effect only if the Commissioner of Health and Social Services certifies to the revisor statutes under section 2 of the act on or before November 1st, 2018, that all provisions added have been approved by the U.S. Department of Health. I'm just trying to coordinate the dates to make sure that we fully understand how that implementation is.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, this will also require some regulation changes, and so the commissioner has to put forth regulations and allow for the public comment period. And regulations typically take approximately 6 months to be able to get through the entire process till they get onto the lieutenant governor's desk. So this is the amount of time that regulations have been taking us, so that's what we asked them to put in this.
Representative Seaton?
And I just received a note that I didn't have in my packet that we've adopted amendment number 2 to take care of that discrepancy. So thank you for it.
Mr. Teal?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Some of you may remember the ProShare program, which was a health and social services thing that dealt with Medicaid payments to hospitals, and that it was sort of this same type of thing superficially, in which the state made payments and didn't recover them, and we ended up having ratifications somewhere near $100 million in costs. And I think that those dates and delaying until the regulations, delaying until you've got the federal certification, is in response to something like that. With those delays, this becomes a pretty low-risk situation for the state to lose money by paying first. And Margaret Brody and I discussed this on the phone last week. In addition to the certification, there's recourse. If we don't get reimbursed from the federal government, we can probably get the money back from the municipalities. So again, low risk of state loss, unlike ProShare.
Do we have any further questions in the committee? Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure we get on the record, and I want to verify, although this shows that we're going to get the money all the way to 2024, that's only if the program holds to the agreement that we have right now. If the program goes away, we're not going to be required to backfill this with state dollars. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that is correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? Seeing none, if we're ready to move the bill, I would ask for a motion.
Chairman, and we already passed these amendments, right?
Correct.
Just want to make sure. Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move HB 176 version 30LS0705/O from House Finance Committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Are there any objections? Seeing none. HB 176 version 30-LS0705/O as an Oscar, as amended with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes, is reported out from House Finance Committee. With that, we'll take a brief at ease to sign the report. Okay, House Finance back in record, 9:22 a.m. Our next piece of business is HB 301, which is alcohol licenses, beverage dispensary restaurants. It's also by Representative Wool. We last heard this bill on February 20th. We introduced a CS, concluded public testimony, and my office did not receive any amendments. So at this time, I'd like to ask Representative Wool and his aide, Mr. Earle, if they could, or actually, yeah, no, Ms. No, it looks like just Representative Wool today. And if you could just put yourself on the record, and if there's anything else that you'd like to add, you're welcome to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's great to be back. My staffer, Laura Steidolf, is sick today, so I'm here to answer any and all questions that you have. Nothing has really changed since the last committee meeting.
Thank you. I'd also like to note that we have online Ms. Erica McConnell, the ABC Board Director, and Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So since we were here last, we asked our legal department whether or not this would grandfather anybody in, as our laws continuously change. And we were told, yes, it would, that this would not just impact the businesses that we're currently trying to take care of. Is that your understanding?
That was
I'm gonna go with no, just by the look on your face.
That was not my my understanding that this was to correct the licenses of the 34 businesses that were caught in sort of the limbo between the 1985 passage and when the law didn't explicitly say that someone having a legal license before then wasn't able to still operate.
Representative Wilson?
So I don't know whether it changes, the intent. Because I'm just torn between that, because I personally believe that if you start a business underneath a certain set of rules and you make the investment, and I think that's kind of what has happened, why this bill is in front of us, is because you had businesses that went in with an understanding, then all of a sudden our laws changed and put them in basically made them have illegal establishments. So I'm okay with that. I just wanted to bring it to your attention that it doesn't necessarily just grandfather these businesses in, that it could also potentially affect others if the laws change. Right now, those laws our current laws only impact the ones that you have addressed, but it's my understanding that if we do another big rewrite, and the same thing happens to businesses that are like your business,
sure,
that's there, and all of a sudden it says that you can only have a bar at a certain size and yours is larger than that, this bill would also take care of that issue too.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I'm not sure I can speak to what a future rewrite will look like as far as how it will affect currently operating businesses, and hopefully a future rewrite will include language that will do what this bill is trying to do, which is to say that if you've been in business for, in this case, some of many decades, that a changing of the room requirement is what happened, that the people that abided by the law, got their license, won't lose it. So this bill affects the 34 businesses that are right now in question, and as I understand your question, it's to be in the future, if something happens with the Title IV rewrite, for example, will this bill cover all those? And I think this one's specific to the time period that we're talking about of 1985 and when the room requirement was changed for the beverage tourism license. And perhaps Ms. McConnell can address your question. But I think I understand if you're saying if something happens in the future, will this bill cover all those businesses that may be affected? And
my understanding is yes, it would. And I guess that's what it, and I guess I just want to bring up, because I think we just need to be cognizant when we have businesses come to our state underneath a set of rules, and then we change the rules, and they can't necessarily change their makeup of what their business did. But we can ask, the chairman see if she has the same understanding that this would grandfather any businesses if those rules were to change.
Sure. And through the chair, Representative Wilson, I guess you're sort of speaking in a hypothetical, and I know sometimes laws change and businesses have to adjust according to the change in law. Say that the drinking age has changed and businesses had to adjust to that. So they weren't exempt because they were open before the drinking age changed. So maybe Ms. McConnell can shed a little different light on it.
Ms. McConnell, if you're there, if you could put yourself on the record, and we can ask the question again if you didn't hear it. Otherwise, please answer the question.
For the record, my name is Erica McConnell. I'm the director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. And, Mr. Chair, I would appreciate having the question repeated.
Okay, if you could please ask the question again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the question is, does this bill make it to where, let's just say there's a rewrite of the bill that just, and I'm going to talk about drinking age, that's completely different, that would change, now you have to have 20 rooms instead of 10 rooms. You know, it's my understanding that the businesses that are currently in, underneath the rules that they are, this would always grandfather them in if the rules were to change, like they did this last time.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I would agree with that, and I think it's actually important that the bill does that. So if you look at page 4 in the new text, it says that the board may approve the renewal or transfer of ownership if the facility maintains at least the minimum number of rental rooms that they had at the time of initial licensure or were required at the time of initial licensure. And the reason that that's important is that if a community has a certain number of people today, and so a facility is required to provide 20 rooms, but in 10 years that community has grown and now the facility would need to provide 30 rooms, this says no, they don't need to provide 30 rooms. They only need to have the number of rooms that were required at the time of initial licensure. So I would agree with that statement, and I think that is a positive thing.
Mr. Chairman, and I wasn't saying it was negative. I was just trying to make sure that, you know, it's just on the record that we really are trying to protect people's investments. Based on those that were following the rule, they're not the ones that kind of broke it. We just changed the laws as we went. So thank you.
Thank you. I'd also like to recognize that we're joined by Representative Kopp. Thanks for being here. Kopp, thanks for being here. And so, let's see here. If there are no further questions, over to the fiscal notes. Representative Guerra, if you could walk us through the fiscal note.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. House Bill 301 only has one fiscal note from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, Appropriation, Alcohol, and Marijuana Control Office. Same allocation, OMB component number 3119. And again, it's a zero fiscal note because it just continues a license that exists right now.
Do we have any questions on the fiscal notes? Seeing none, if we're ready to move the bill, Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we move the bill, and I appreciate Representative Wool bringing this forward, I did just want to say that, you know, we've been working a lot with Title IV and understanding what happens with AMCO, the ABC side, and the marijuana side over the last several weeks. But I just wanted to put this in the record because somebody contacted our office on it. This is from an organization in town. It's called the Riverfront Theater. It's the Fairbanks Drama Association for our Fairbanks guys who know it. They're open during performances for 54 hours. They pay $24.75 a year for the license. They have to secure the signature of licensees of the licensee 66 times. They file 435 paperworks. 435 pages of paperwork to be open for those 54 hours when they have performances. They're open usually an hour before the show, 20 minutes during intermission. So they pay $50 for each of 33 permits, plus $25 to the Fairbanks Police Department for background checks and a 5% liquor tax. So on a good night, sometimes they make $200 in revenues. And $75 is their overhead just from ABC. And so I just, you know, I know this is not the bill to deal with it, and there's a Title IV rewrite that might work out, but that seems like a pretty large bureaucratic burden especially for a nonprofit business like the Fairbanks Drama Association. So I just wanted to put that on the record, and I know Representative Wool would agree with the legislative and bureaucratic burden. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kawasaki. Do we have any further comments? Seeing none, I would entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House Bill 301, version 30, LS 1217/E, from House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note.
Are there any objections? Seeing no objections, HB 301 version 30-LS1217/E4ECO with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note is reported out from House Finance Committee. And with that, we'll take another brief at ease while we sign the report. Okay, House Finance back on record, 9:33 a.m. Our next bill up today is HB 38, which is Workers' Compensation Death Benefits by Representative Josephson. Committee last heard this bill on February 15th. We accepted one amendment on this, which was on the effective date, and the committee was waiting for an updated fiscal note that we have now received. So at this time, I don't believe Representative Josephson is here, but his aide, Megan Holland, if you could come to the table. And if there's anything else that you would like to add on this, also available to help answer questions, we have Ms. Marie Marks, Director of Workers' Compensation. And so with that, Ms. Holland.
For the record, Megan Holland, staff to Representative Josephson. I don't have anything to add at this time, but I'm available for any questions if members may have them.
Maybe if you could remain at the table, we'll go ahead and bring up Ms. Marks. And if Ms. Marks, you could put yourself on the record and also just walk us through the fiscal notes.
For the record, my name is Marie Marks. I'm the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. For the Division of Workers' Compensation for the Department of Labor, there's one fiscal note, and that is a zero fiscal note. Chair Foster, and that is because there is zero fiscal impacts on the department. It will not change the way the division administers or operates the Alaska Workers' Compensation Act.
Thank you. We've got a question from Representative Wilson.
So I'm assuming the other two fiscal notes that are in here are no longer valid. I just want to make sure. So we're only talking about component number 344.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, there is a fiscal note from the Department of Administration, Division of Risk Management, and I believe there is also one from OMB. Just if you would like me to speak briefly about them, I think what those fiscal notes say, though I probably should defer to those departments to speak on their fiscal notes, but essentially what I believe what they say is, my understanding is that benefits and costs associated with this legislation, they're paid for by insurance companies and self-insured employers. And the state of Alaska, of course, is one of those self-insured employers. And so through the Department of Administration Risk Management, the cost will be passed on, will be collected and assessed to the risk management, and then it will be passed on to all state agencies through increased personal services benefits costs, including in future year budget salary and benefit adjustments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We do have, for the Department of Administration Risk Management, Scott Jordan. Is he must be online?
That answered my question.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So with that, I don't know. Did you want David Teal up here for the any other questions on? No. Okay. Okay. Well, with that, moving right along. Do we have any other questions on the fiscal notes? Seeing none. If there are no other questions or comments on the bill, I would Representative Wilson?
I just want to put it on the record because I had the amendment, and we worked really hard with a lot of different groups to – I'm still concerned that I understand the process and for that and the mediation that it makes it cleaner. But I do think sometimes accidents are accidents that could have been prevented. And if you have somebody who has had a lot of violations, that should be dealt with separately, and they should have that opportunity to go to court. We have yet to be able to figure out how you would do that language, because the language I did basically would have made it to where everybody could go to court, because the courts would then determine who was at gross negligence, and that kind of just really makes the program not work at all. We try to make it OSHA violations, a whole lot different, and we're still working on that, and probably will continue to see if we could find language. But I just want to make sure that I understand why we do what we do, but I am truly concerned if you have, luckily, I don't think we have a lot, but an employer who decides to ignore safety as a priority and has been found guilty through different procedures, and then someone, unfortunately, is the next one to touch that apparatus or whatever it is and unfortunately be permanently injured or even ultimately killed, that there really should be a different type of punishment than just putting a number on someone's life. But so if anybody out there has any kind of suggestions on how we would do that so we don't break the system, I appreciate it.
Thank you. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a similar concern as Representative Wilson, and to the extent folks can come up with language that's sensible by the House floor that the sponsor also agrees with, I'd be interested also.
If you do have any further comments or questions? Seeing none, I would entertain a motion. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House Bill 38, version 30LS0160/R from House Finance Committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Do you have any objections?
Mr. Chair, I do object.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I mean, my concern still lies that we're changing the essentially changing this from where the intent has been to compensate an injured worker or their dependents. We're now going beyond the dependents, and that's a concern because we already have such high costs of workman's comp in Alaska. In addition to, of course, there's also the CPI adjustment that's in there. And so, Mr. Chair, you know, based on the fact that this is altering, I think, the very concept that we've had for years of what workman's comp has supposed to do, which is compensate the injured worker and help the dependents of that worker. And this is now going to an estate. I think that's changing the, you know, where we've always felt the workman's comp's intent has been. So with that, I maintain an objection.
Objection is maintained. Representative Gurr.
Thanks, Chair. You know, I've worked in this area. I knew a gentleman who got run over by a truck that had no backup sound. And so the alert didn't work. He was busy doing his job. He got run over. And the current law says that if you die, your life is valueless if you don't have a spouse or child. And this law says that if in that case, then the parent is entitled to the compensation. It's not very much compensation. It's almost an insulting level of compensation. But to say that the person who ran over the person who died doesn't have to pay anything, I think is wrong. So I support the bill. And I do think that life has some value.
Thank you. Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, just one clarification. The person that runs over is not paying anything. And I think that's the whole – that's the concern that we have here. If the person has been negligent – and I think that's the point that Representative Wilson was trying to get at. If the person is negligent, then they should participate in the dealing with the – however we would value. And I agree, there's no way we can ever put a price or a value. We cannot pay for the value of that life. But this is not that person that was negligent paying. This is now having the system deal with it. I think that's the fault in the challenge here. they came to us recognizing that the individual who passed away, they were not able to go to the person who was negligent. And I think that's something that we have not been able to address in this particular legislation, was the person that was negligent is not necessarily paying for their failure to do what they should do. Instead, we're looking to this system to then cover that. And I get the concern. I think it's a valid concern. I don't think this legislation really truly handles that concern that initially arose.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If somebody, before this, gets to the floor, could answer, and I didn't think of it until just what Representative Pruitt brought up, by making this change in the law and now allowing money to go to someone other than a spouse or a child, are we now actually preventing them from going forward with a lawsuit? Because before, if my understanding is, a lawsuit was tied to the workers' comp. So the workers' comp, the person who received the workers' comp, basically, in workers' comp, agreed on a certain amount of money. But now you have this group of, let's say, a parent who lost a child. They were involved in the workers' comp issue. They kind of sit outside of it, which I would think then they would have that opportunity to sue. If we now put them within the system itself, are we now, tying their hands just like we do the worker who has that permanent disability who's going through that? I don't know the answer, and I'm not going to hold the bill up to get the answer, because it just kind of hit me that we're now adding another group into this mediation portion of it, where they actually might be better being outside of it, because it may give them more resources if it happens to be something that could have been prevented.
Representative Guerra and then Representative Seaton.
Thank you. In answer to Representative Wilson's question, the workers' comp system is exclusive. So right now, the parent wouldn't have any recourse in court. And in response to Representative Pruitt, if the employer negligently or not negligently or gross negligently runs over an employee and kills the employee, right now, if that employee had no spouse or children, the parent is not entitled to anything. The bill now says that employer is responsible through the workers' comp system, and I think that is fair.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think we conflate a couple of issues. One that we would like to get to is to the gross negligence, and that really wasn't the subject of this bill. This bill was looking at insurance, and should the insurance be provided to parents and others of the deceased, or is it only covering dependents? So if you had a child who was 18 years old and was killed on the job and they weren't married, then there's no compensation currently to the parent. Is there any loss there? I think we'd all agree there's a loss there. The question is whether we want to look at the insurance coverage and say, yes, workers' comp is providing that compensation. And I believe that workers' comp still covers the funeral expenses. So there is the workers' comp coverage of that individual, whether the parents are involved in receiving any compensation at all. So I hope we can separate these two issues and realize that the insurance should cover the loss of the worker, we can solve the other problems in future debate. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any further comments? No. Is the objection maintained?
Yes.
The objection is maintained. Could the Secretary please call the roll? Roll.
Representative Wilson.
No.
Representative Guerra.
Yes.
Representative Grant.
Yes.
Representative Kalsoff.
Yes.
Representative Ortiz.
Yes.
Representative Pruitt.
No.
Representative Thompson.
No.
Representative Tilton.
No.
Representative Foster.
Yes.
Representative Seaton.
Yes.
Six yeas, four nays.
And so on a vote of six yeas to four nays, HB 38, version 30-LS0160/R as amended with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes is reported out from the House Finance Committee, adopted. So with that, we'll take another brief at ease, sign the report. Okay, House Finance, background record, 9:49 a.m. Our next bill up today is HB 168, which is the repeal of the Administrative Regulation Review Committee. It's by Representative Chenault. HB 168 and HCR 10 will go together as a package. And so here to present the bill is Representative Chenault and his aide, Mr. Tom Wright. And if you could please both put yourselves on the record, and as you speak, if you could just identify yourselves, since we've got two male voices, and with that, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Representative Mike Chenault. I represent District 29 on the Kenai Peninsula. I also have with me today my staff, Tom Wright.
Thank you.
Tom Wright, staff to Rep. Chenault.
Just so you didn't get the voices confused, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, if I may, thank you, committee members. House Bill 168 proposes to repeal the statute pertaining to the Administrative Regulation Review Committee. According to the analysis that's been provided by the Ledge Research, that's included in your package, the ARRC has not overturned any regulation as a result of committee hearings. And this goes back, I believe, they researched it back to 2003. So I don't have any record beyond that. Although AS 2420.445 provides that the committee can suspend regulations for a certain period of time, the Alaska Supreme Court found in a 1980 case that the legislature has no implied power to veto agency regulations by informal legislative action, and such actions would violate the Article 2 of the state constitutions. The Administrative Regulation Review Committee does have the ability to introduce a piece of legislation to nullify regulations, but that's the only way that regulation can be nullified without it can't be nullified by just a review in a committee. So, as I said earlier, there's been no effort since 2003 to present to could find any any regulations that the committee had put legislation in to get rid of. So, House Bill 168 repeals all the references to the ARRC throughout the statutes, sexual analysis reference, and references the statutes where the AAR or ARRC is to be repealed. And also, Mr. Chairman, if I may, the House Concurrent Resolution 10, which also accompanies 168, is also proposed. It allows the jurisdiction of the Standing Committee to oversee the proposed or adopted regulations to replace the regulation oversight that is currently under the jurisdiction of the ARRC. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that's the two bills you have before you. I also believe that there was no funding last year in last year's budget for the Reg Review Committee, and so far I haven't seen any in the proposed budget for this year. So, Mr. Chairman, we're here to try to answer any questions that the committee may have, and thank you.
Thank you, Representative Chenault. Does the committee have any questions for the sponsor? Seeing none, thank you. We will go to public testimony. And public testimony is now open on HB 168 and HCR 10. Is there anybody in the room who would like to testify? Seeing nobody, is there anybody online who would like to testify? We do have, let's see here.
Yes, hello, Chairman Foster. This is Ed Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. If you could identify your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, I'm Mike Chenault, constituent in House District 29. I oppose this measure that my representative is putting forward because of the intent of the original creation of the Administrative Regulation Review Committee. This is our first line of defense by and through the legislators of our state to review regulations rolled out by the executive branch to make certain that those laws follow the intent of law. Now, Mike might say nothing's been done since 2003, but I can tell you this board's been in force for quite some time, this committee. It's made up of three members of the House and three members of the Senate that I would hope would want to feel it very imperative that they review regulations from any new administration. As you folks are well aware, we have a very strong governor. And, in fact, they may take a law and change its intent through regulation that imposes civil and criminal penalties against the citizens. Recently, we had a marijuana control board that was put together, was not approved by you people until after the regulations were rolled out, and of which I had heartburn about, because I could not go into business in my own state because I wasn't a so-called permanent fund applicant. Now, that would have been caught by you folks, and it was not the intent of the law, yet it still is in effect, and no one has taken the time to review this. Going with HCR 10, and oh, by the way, you might want to go to your sponsor state page and correct the difference between HCR 7 and 10 because it's not labeled properly, by the way. But I did get to read the intent of HCR 10. And to be honest with you, this spreads out this obligation that I feel it was put together for a very good purpose. And if you read the full intent of the original enactment of the Administrative Regulation Review Committee, you'll find out that this is a dedicated committee that will take those regulations within 45 days of them being enacted and review them so that no arbitrary and capricious laws come against the citizens for which they have to go through arduous and very expensive. And I've done this. I personally have lent myself into this system and went all the way into the courts to argue against regulations that were arbitrary and capricious. Now, this shouldn't be what the citizens have to do. you folks should take on your responsibilities as reviewing the intent of law rolled out in regulations so they do not harm the individual liberties and or make criminals of people when they never should be. Now, I could probably go on much further, but I do appreciate this committee's the opportunity for me to speak on this. Please do not do away with this first line of defense in the protection of our liberties. And I thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Martin, for calling in, looks like from Cooper Landing. Do we have any further public testimony? Anybody else online? And it doesn't look like we have anybody else, so with that, we will close public testimony. And for folks who may be watching on TV, if you'd like, you can submit your written testimony to housefinance@akleg.com. And so with that...
.gov.
I'm sorry, .gov. Thank you. That's housefinance@akleg.gov. And it looks like we've got zero fiscal notes. Is there any desire for the committee to walk through those? Representative Wilson?
No, but I do want to put on the record that we're not, we may be getting rid of reg review as a committee, but we're actually going to send the reg review back to the standing committee. And to me, that's important because at the end of the day, if the administration won't listen to us about a regulation, then we have to clarify statute, which has to be done in a bill. So I think it puts it more appropriately in the standing committees who then have that process to be able to put a bill forward. So I just want to make sure that we know that looking at regulations are very important here, and we get misinterpreted, I think, a lot sometimes. And so we're not giving it up. We're just changing the way the process works.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I served as vice chair of Reg Review. I can't remember what it was, 4 and 5, or what was it, back in 2005 and 2006, when it was chaired in the Senate. But for the House side, you know, as the vice chair, because it's a joint committee, has a vice chair from one body and the chairman from the other, I notified all the committee chairmen for the standing committees, committees of jurisdiction, that, you know, it was, we considered it one of their duties to have their committee aide review all the regulations as they were published, because that's when we can really make the change. When the regulations are drafted and go out for public comment, if the committee takes it as their responsibility of jurisdiction to review those regulations, because they're familiar with all those items, they can have public input into the process at that time. And we did have several regulations withdrawn, changed based on the comments that were submitted. So it's possible to do this on the front end. The problem is that the Supreme Court decision of separation of powers took away the ability for the Reg Review Committee to come in and pass a resolution or anything to annul a regulation. So it's really up to the committees of jurisdiction who are deeply involved in those issues over which they have jurisdiction to look at all the regulations as they come out within that jurisdiction and make sure they apply to the statutes. And having one committee that is trying to look at all the regulations across all these different jurisdictions was really not very efficient, because people have an area of interest. That's why they're on committees. And so I ask, you know, for the committees at that time to take those looks. And it made a difference. So I think putting this back into the committee structure of the committees of jurisdiction for those items will be much more effective at controlling any regulations that might be outside the purview of the statutes than waiting until the statute goes into effect and trying to make a change then, because as we know, it takes a bill going through both bodies and being signed by the governor to overturn the regulation. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm supportive of the bill, and I just wanted to put on the record that there is a procedure, but it's going to be incumbent upon we legislators and each committee chairman and the minority members on the committees as well to look at regulations and look at the statutes, and all the committee members that are following those things to do it. Doesn't have to be in the official capacity, but it at meetings, because I know the meetings are, have a lot of time, but I think that we can accomplish this. So I support both of these pieces.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I remember when this bill first came up, and if you've been around the legislature for a while, you know that it doesn't quite function unless the chairperson is somebody that's really motivated to get action done. And for Representative Gren, we haven't had one since you've been here, so it's like I won't miss it. But I will say this though, I have a little bit of trouble supporting this legislation at this time. Because I think just because the lack of results that we seem to have had since, for many years, I think, from the Admin Reg Review Committee, it does serve a real public purpose. And we talk about standing committees perhaps taking up the work and the volume of stuff that might come through that. This is, if I can remind folks, a part-time legislature, a legislature that isn't supposed to be here all year. And so we go on to our other jobs or other careers or other lives after we're done in 90 days. And so the reason for the Admin Reg Review was, I think, is clear when it was adopted in 75 as it is today. It's a permanent interim committee that has both members of the House and the Senate hammering these regulations out as they receive them. And I think that's fully appropriate. I think, you know, just reading the actual purpose drafted in 75, the establishment of this committee recognizes the need for prompt legislative review of those regulations filed by the lieutenant governor, something that a standing committee that only meets 90 days out of the year really can't do. I recognize it hasn't been a tool that has been used as often as it should, but I think it absolutely should be a tool that should be used. We've seen regulations come before this body that we have disagreed on. I mean, I'll just point out one dealing with the distillery bill that passed several years ago. There's a regulation that just passed the ABC board, and it was an interpretation of the law that we had passed. I could tell you that the 12 or so members of the House who voted on that legislation, 100% felt that legislative intent was met when they said we vote on this bill. And I, as a co-sponsor, it was my legislative intent not to have folks mix their own drinks at distilleries. But that's where we're at today. The Admin Reg Review Committee could have been a useful tool in really delving into the regulation that I think some of us may agree or disagree with. So I'm not supportive of this legislation. I think that this does serve an important and useful purpose within the legislature, and I just don't want to see our executive branch sort of run roughshod over what the legislature and legislative intent is. We're the lawmaking body, regulations can be propagated as we've seen, I think, contrary to what the legislature believes in. And so I'm not supportive of this right now. I recognize that it hasn't been utilized to the fullest extent, but if I were chairman, it would be. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could have the sponsor of the bill, I have a question. Representative Chenault, could you come up?
Representative Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record again, Representative Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Chenault. Taking into consideration the comments of your constituent as well as Representative Kawasaki, but also recognizing the supportive comments of Representative Seaton for your bill, what's the impact of, is this a fiscal savings? It doesn't seem to be. What would be wrong with just leaving things as they are? It's not funded. but still the potential is there for the committee to go into action if, in fact, it's needed. What do you say to that?
And, Representative Ortiz, through the chair, I think it's good that we take things off the books when they're not needed. We have a reg review committee that over the last 14 years, I think, met a total of 30 times. And 15 of those meetings were during the, I believe, the 28th legislature. Since 2003, no legislation has come out of that reg review committee that repealed any regulations as far as Ledge Legal could tell us. So as long as there is a committee that has the jurisdiction to review those regulations as they come out through the administration, then I feel very comfortable with taking reg review out of the statutes. I think, as Representative Seaton stated earlier, if you're in resources and there's review and there's regulations being written for a resource issue, you're more apt to look at that regulation than if you're just on a committee that you know. And I know that when I was a speaker and as I was a finance co-chair through my career, we've seen a number of regulations that we thought didn't look right to us, or we didn't like how they wrote them, and we would put them before a reg review. And as I stated, since 2003. There's been no legislation proposed by reg review, so if it's if you're just keeping it on the books to keep it on the books, I think we need to get rid of it.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, In the case where we are not meeting as a legislature, we're in an interim session. Are we giving up some potential oversight ability for the legislature on administrative actions by taking this action? In other words, are we giving up a check on administration or on the governor's office by taking this action? And I guess I would say is, if there's no cost, if there's no financial gain, then why give up the administrative or the chance to do it, to be a check on the governor?
And Representative Ortiz, through the chair, there is a cost. I believe that If my memory, and maybe the chairman of the operating budget can help me out, but I think that the cost originally was about 60, not much, but I think it was about $60,000 a year that was allocated for reg review. And some of that was to hire, I believe, a lawyer, and very few of the committee chairmen that ran reg review actually had a lawyer on staff. When you want to talk about meetings, reg review is no different than any of the other committees. They can call a meeting at any time. They can't pass legislation just like other committees can't. They can't pass legislation during the interim. So, you know, they're limited to that aspect. They could meet just like the committee could. They could discuss if they wanted to draft legislation that would change that regulation. And, you know, they could get that drafted and have it ready for session, but that's, I believe they're under the same requirements as any other committee is, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Thank you.
Representative Guerra, and then Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with the bill. I think it takes up legislator time when we have bigger problems. So that's not a cost. That's just a cost to society, not a financial cost. We have much bigger problems to deal with. When an agency issues a regulation, every one of us gets to see the regulation. Every one of us gets to comment if we want to comment on it. And if we don't like the regulation in a pass, every one of us gets to do what the members of that committee could do if they want, which is to file legislation and try and reverse that regulation. You don't need a committee to do any of those things. And in my experience, the Reg Review Committee has been, you know, what Shakespeare called full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. People see a regulation, they make a lot of speeches about the regulation, and they don't do anything as a committee. Now, a legislator might, but a legislator can. It's not a committee that gives you any more power. It's not a committee that that gives you any more information than you can get on your own as a legislator who does not like a regulation. You don't need a committee. I've got to say the truth. The committee, by some, was thought back in the 90s as a good way for one party to take a look at another party's governor's regulations. But so little has come out of it, and there's just a lot of time by legislators. We got bigger problems. So.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would note that, you know, I agree with the idea of during the interim, legislators are doing other things, but every committee has a committee aide that is hired year-round, and the committee aide, that's what we, when I was the vice chair, my instruction was to every committee chairman that this is a job for your committee aide to do, is as these regulations come up, because those are the people that understand the statutes. They've been on the committee. If you're in resources, you're looking at those things in resources. If you're on health and social services, your committee aide is spooled up on that. If you have a separate committee that's supposed to understand all of the agencies and all of the committees in the legislature, it is much less focused. So I do want to say that there is a cost. When I was the vice chair, the committee chair hired a lawyer, and a lawyer reviewed every regulation that was put out by the administration, and that took a lot of time. And I think was a full-time job for that lawyer. And so the question is, do we want to, as a legislature, hire a lawyer just to review those regulations? We could do that. We don't need the regular reg review committee to do that. But again, I just want to say that this shouldn't be once regs come out. It should be when regs are drafted and they come out for public comment. Because I've seen numerous times where I have made comments, and other people have as well, where the regs got changed. That's the purpose of public comment. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Wright, and then Representative Ortiz.
I think we have a prime example of legislation that was introduced this year when DOT proposed the aircraft registration fee. There were so many negative comments, at least that were directed toward our office, but a piece of legislation was filed. And when there is a regulation that is considered onerous by the public, you hear about it. And there have been examples in the past, and I don't have them in front of me, but legislation has been introduced by individual legislators to nullify those regulations. And again, the aircraft registration fee is one of those examples.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz.
So finally, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Starting to be persuaded by the wisdom and the knowledge of those of you folks who have obviously had a lot more institutional history than myself. Final question would be, then why did we have it in the first place? In other words, if this is so clearly not needed, how did it ever come to be?
Representative Chenault.
I can't answer that one, Mr. Chairman. Somebody thought it was important. For one reason or another.
With the preface that no political party owns the monopoly on competence or not competence, back in the 90s, I think there were some legislators who did not trust the regulations coming out of the Knowles administration from the other party. And so they created the Reg Review Committee. And then when we had an all-Republican legislator with Governor Murkowski, it barely ever met. And you can imagine the reverse happening, right? But you don't need a committee to take a look at stuff like that. It's, you know, it was a nice experiment. It diverted legislator time from more important things. But I think that's how it came into account. And it could have very well been, you know, the other party doing it with another party's governor, too. So.
Representative Seaton and then Pruitt.
And, Mr. Chairman, just to answer the question again, that was in a time when we thought that the committee could nullify regulations. And the Supreme Court has since said that the chief function of the committee is unconstitutional. So at this point in time, we're looking for efficiencies in government, not spending money on things that we can't accomplish. So that's why I support the legislation.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually think it goes back to the 70s, and the Supreme Court case that State versus Live Voluntary was in 1980. I believe in that court case in 1980 basically, I think, took the teeth behind what the intent of the initial organization of the committee was for. But as an additional note, that Mr. Chair, I think, you know, if the House felt that it was important to continue to analyze regulation, let's say here in a period of time next, you know, 4 years from now, we decided, hey, there's just too many regulations being written. I mean, mind you, we have at the time created special committees. Right, we have several that are created now. We can do that through a resolution. The House can do it on their own. The Senate can do it on their own. Or we can, together, create joint through resolutions. So if we felt that this was still important, I think we should recognize we have the ability to do something, even if it's on a temporary basis. But I think the reason that the committee was initially established was essentially nullified by the Supreme Court. And while it continued to maybe be utilized in the capacity that the member from downtown had kind of highlighted, that part I can't confirm or deny. At this point in time, I agree that we have just not seen it appropriately being utilized for what I think the intent was. And if there is a way to print less ink in our statute books, I think we've talked about that a lot. It's probably appropriate. And this is another opportunity for us to do that. Well, not just, I think we'll have another one that comes up that will print less ink in our uniform rules books. You know, that's appropriate. There's no reason to necessarily have things on the books that we're no longer utilizing. And I think this was, the idea of it is good, but since it can't do what we really want it to do, which is to essentially nullify regulation, then maybe it's time to go ahead and shut the book on this and move forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Wilson?
I have a question for the sponsor. So on the airplane fee, the last regulation that was brought to our attention, did the Reg Review Committee meet on that?
Representative Chenault?
On which item?
The airplane. I can call it an airplane fee because I can't remember what exactly it was called, but the last regulation that really registration fee.
There wasn't a committee named at the present time, Representative Wilson through the chair.
So my point is that because the public got involved, and we did also, because I want to make sure it's on record that we believe reviewing regulation is very, very important. The question is, where should it be at? So I just want to show that one of the most controversial ones I think we've had, because the public chose to get involved, and they really did get involved, and legislation was brought forward, that regulation didn't happen. And it happened like Representative Seaton said it should. It happened during the public comment period because it's almost impossible without legislation to reverse a regulation. But the time to do it is getting the right facts out, getting the facts out while it's in the public comment. And I think the best way you're going to do that are by those who, like, sit on resources. I don't know all the things to do with every resource bill that comes because we don't hear necessarily all of them, or if it's health and social services. So those committees kind of live and breathe those bills when they come through, and so they have a better understanding what those regulations will or will not do, and then can actually get information out to the public to make better comment and hopefully stop regulation from happening. That is not the intent of it. So I just want to make sure that there's we do believe in reviewing regulation. The question is, where is the best place to have it happen? And I think in the expert groups, which is your standing committees on these issues.
Any further questions or comments? Seeing none. Done public testimony. And so. And then the fiscal notes. Well, I'm sorry. So I guess what is the will of the committee on this? I know we're not. We're okay. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Wilson? I think we should move this. I think that the sooner we do it, the better it is, and we can make sure that those who are sitting on those committees can know this is a responsibility they've already had. We're just confirming it, because I do believe that the standing committees already get this. I know we do on those, and help the public understand the process that we're going to make it work better.
Okay. Well, I would ask to entertain a motion on the first bill, HB 168, if it is the will of the committee. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move House Bill 168, 30LS0682/A from committee with individual recommendations attached to fiscal note. Zero fiscal note.
Are there any objections? Seeing none, HB 168, version 30-LS0682/A with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note is reported out from House Finance Committee. And with that, we'll take a brief at ease. House Finance, back on record, 10:24 a.m. And with that, we had two things before us, HB 168. Now we are to HCR 10, and they are both together. And with that, I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
I move House Concurrent Resolution Number 1030-LS0683/A with zero fiscal note and individual recommendations from committee.
Thank you. Do we have any objections? Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, I have no intent, obviously, to maintain my objection. I just think it's important to highlight that this particular resolution, what it does is essentially assigns the regulations to the standing committees. So, of course, the jurisdiction of the standing committee over the programs and activities under the rules. So this is doing the other side of it that I think we were talking about previously. This is where we tell our through our uniform rules that it is the intent of the standing committees to look at these regs. And so just for obviously, as so we should have a discussion on every piece of the legislation, that's what this is doing. And it maintains our vigilance in ensuring that we're analyzing regs that come forward. So that I'll remove my objection unless someone else wants to talk
about
it.
Thank you, Representative Pruitt. And maybe if you could maintain that,
I'll maintain.
Ask the sponsor if he's got any additional comments.
You know, through the chair, I guess Representative Pruitt, that's exactly what HCR 10 does, is it makes sure that we know that standing committees do have – they've always had jurisdiction over those regulations that pertain to those particular committees. So we're just making sure that this changes uniform rule that makes sure that those committees know that they have that jurisdiction.
Thank you. Representative Chenault, Representative Kawasaki, and then Seaton.
Just I don't want to belabor it. I want this to move out. But I did just, again, want to state on the record that I do believe there is a purpose of this permanent interim committee, and that as legislators, we're committee members for the 90 days that we're here. We were never intended to be a full-time legislature. Having a permanent interim committee like the Reg Review Committee look at those specifically with partners from both the House and the Senate, I think was an appropriate thing. I recognize it has not functioned as well as it should. I think it should even be enhanced, in my opinion. And we should try to look for a way that legislative intent is met constantly. There are states, Idaho in particular, does have a way and does have an administrative review committee, and they do annul legislation. They do annul regulations coming from individual agencies. And so, I think, as we talk about the growth in some of the laws that we're doing, some of them are not because of us. They're because of the executive branch and because of what they've done. And so, I support having a legislative-appointed committee to review those, and I think it's appropriate to have this permanent interim committee. So I will still oppose it, but I'm not opposed to moving it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Kawasaki. A brief it is. House Finance back on record. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate this resolution putting this actually in the writing of our uniform rules, because when I was vice chair, although I attempted to get all the committees of jurisdiction to review those regs, that was coming from one committee asking the other committees to do the job. But here it will set out in black and white that that's the duty of the committee, and the committee aide will then be tasked with that by the committee chairman during the interim, and so that if the committee chair wants to follow the uniform rules, they'll know that that's within their responsibility as adopted by the legislature, not just by a request of the Reg Review Committee. So I appreciate this, and I'll support resolution.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. Do we have any further comments? I just want to note that we did, when we opened up public testimony earlier, it was for both HB 168 and HCR 10. I don't see anybody online wanting to testify on HCR 10. I just want to make sure nobody in the room is here wanting to testify on that. So with that, is the objection maintained? The objection has been removed. Are there any further objections? Seeing none, HCR 10, version 30-LS0683/A, with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note, is reported out from House Finance Committee. And with that, let's take a brief at ease to sign the report. Yeah, our last bill up today is HB 110. It is the massage therapy licensing and exemptions by Representative Keto. And here to present are Representative Keto and his aide, Ms. Crystal Kinnaman. And, or Ms. Kinnaman, if you could put yourself on the record and proceed. I also want to mention that we have available for questions Mr. David Edward Smith, Chairman of the Massage Therapy Board. And so with that, Ms. Kinnaman, if you could walk us through.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Crystal Kinnaman, staff to Representative Keto. He does apologize. He was here earlier hoping we would move through the calendar a little bit earlier. He does have first Thursday of every month. He's on KINY, a local radio station, so that's where he is right now. So he apologizes for not being here. House Bill 110, you all will remember recently there was the massage massage board extension that had come through committee a couple weeks ago. This kind of goes in conjunction with that bill. These changes were brought to us by the Massage Therapy Board with the understanding that they are a new board, they new licensure program, and through the last couple years, they've realized that some of the things in their statutes need to be cleaned up. So this is a cleanup piece of legislation that will ease the burden on licensees as well as the department and the board. So hopefully it will result in licensees being licensed quickly, more effectively. And so a couple things that the bill does, it eases the restriction for those who wish to be public members on the board. Representative Pruitt had mentioned that was one of the concerns. Boards and commissions has had a heck of a time trying to find public members to sit on the board. It removes the language for a former member of any board to be able to sit on this board. The House Bill 110 also includes language for the board to adopt regulations regarding massage therapy establishments. It increases the number of hours of in-class supervised instruction and clinical work from an approved massage school from 500 hours to 625 hours. It reduces the number of hours of safety education covering bloodborne pathogens from 4 hours to 2 hours. It changes the annual fingerprint requirement to once every 6 years or 3 renewal cycles. It has a July 1, 2019 effective date. Dave Edward Smith, the chair of the Massage Therapy Board, is online. I will defer to him for the technical questions. They are the ones that brought this bill before us, and so I would defer to him to answer the justification and reasoning behind these changes. And with that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my presentation.
Thank you. Representative Kovsok.
Thank you. Thanks, Ms. Kinnaman, for being here. We've seen the bill and we've sort of hashed through this. The only questions I have are dealing with the hours of study. We're increasing the hours from 500 to 625 and decreasing the numbers of hours for safety education for bloodborne pathogens from 4 to 2. Can you tell me the justification for this?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair. Again, I will defer to Dave Edward Smith to go through that justification.
And would you like to get that question answered?
Or if there's public testimony, it's fine.
Thank you. Is Mr. Smith online?
Yes.
Would you identify yourself for the record and who you represent and go ahead with your response to Representative Kawasaki's question, if you heard it. If you didn't, we'll have him repeat it.
Yes, this is Dave Edward Smith. I'm the chair of the Alaska Board of Massage Therapists, and thank you for your question through the chair, Mr. Kawasaki. The bloodborne pathogen requirement currently in statute is 4 credit hours. The national standard for a bloodborne pathogen course is 2. So currently, we have there's no such thing as a 4 credit hour class. So we have applicants that are taking a 2 hour credit class tw- twice in order to meet the statutory requirements for licensure. On the question of the education requirements moving from 500 to 625 hours, there was an entry-level analysis project completed by seven different national massage agencies, and the conclusion was the national standard for education is now 625 hours. This is a standard that schools currently meet and exceed nationally, and essentially it's 500 hours is an outdated number, and this requirement of 625 will have no impact on any schools within the state of Alaska, and we do not expect impact in a reciprocity with other states as far as meeting requirements for licensure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, we'll go to public testimony. Thank you, Ms. Kidd.
Thank you.
And we'll open public testimony. Do we have anyone in the room who would like to testify on House Bill 110? Anyone online? Let's see. We have Volker Herbley. I probably mispronounced the name.
Yes. Hello.
Yeah.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Volker Ruby. I'm the president of the American Massage Therapy Association, Alaska chapter. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I have been a massage therapist for 13 years and have worked in the spa industry, medical massage, and private practice. We, the AMTA Alaska chapter, represent a large number of massage therapists in Alaska. I am here today to testify in support of the committee substitute for House Bill 110. This new version of the legislation requires the massage board to adopt regulations governing massage therapy establishments in addition to individual therapists. This will give authorities the tools they need to shut down operations of human trafficking and prostitution that try to use massage therapy as a front. It increases the minimum course of study of licensure for from 500 to 625 hours, which, as you heard, is the current national minimum standard. It also changes the safety education covering bloodborne pathogens from 4 to 2 hours, which is also the national standard. And can be mentioned that in massage school, all therapists already took sometimes dozens of hours of bloodborne pathogen education. This is just designed as like a refresher before getting licensure if a certain amount of time has passed since massage school. And finally, it compels fingerprinting requirements be conducted every 6 years instead of every 2 years, and this reduces the fee and paperwork burden on licensees, yet gives periodic checks to help keep criminal elements out of our profession. Since the passage of legislation almost 4 years ago establishing the Board of Massage Therapists and establishing statutes and requirements for the licensure of massage therapists, the need for some minor modifications to that statute has come to light. This bill are these modifications. Mr. Chairman and committee members, we urge you to move this bill from committee. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Ruby? I guess I have one just to make sure. Does this bill contain all the changes that you think you need in the current statute?
Yes, I definitely believe it does.
Thank you for that. Seeing no further questions, let's go back to David Edward Smith. Are you still there? Mr. Smith, did you want to offer other testimony than just answering the question that was posed?
Sure, I can offer some brief testimony through the chair. I'm just here to represent I'm the chair of the Board of Massage Therapists, and we are in full support of this bill, HB 110, as amended by the House Labor Committee. So essentially what this bill does, as we said, is the board views this as a statutory house cleaning bill. So we're reducing the burden on some applicants and licensees. We're modernizing education. We're strengthening our law enforcement's ability to address illicit massage businesses and sex trafficking in Alaska. And I feel it's very important to ease these restrictions for public members to serve on the Board of Massage Therapists, because our past, I feel like our past public board member was a very valuable member of the board, and I feel it's a weakness right now of not having that stringent requirement that is currently within statute. So, well, I look forward to any of your questions, and that's all I have for testimony at this time.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions? I don't see any. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to expand on your testimony instead of being limited to answering the one question that was earlier directed. So thank you. We have Jill Motz. Motz, are you online?
I am.
Would you identify yourself and who you represent for the record and go ahead with your testimony?
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jill Motz. I'm a fourth-generation Alaskan who's been practicing massage therapy since 2003. I live and work in Wasilla and have been an active participant in the massage community for most of my career. I currently hold a position on both the Alaska AMTA and State Massage Therapy Boards. However, today I'm here to give testimony as a therapist and a business owner. Prior to state licensing, regulation was all over the place in Alaska. Different municipalities had different rules, and some had education standards, and some were entirely without education standards. Nearly universally, therapists complained that they got nothing for the money that they paid for licensing in their municipalities, and there was no centralized place to take complaints. The changes proposed in this bill will help address these issues with a centralized place for therapists, the public, and law enforcement to go with issues that face our profession. As a business owner, I feel that it's critical to address the human trafficking issue. Establishment licensing provides necessary tools to our board and law enforcement to address prostitution and human trafficking in Alaska. Only licensing massage therapists does not help address the issue of predatory owners running illicit businesses. Under current statutes, only massage therapists are accountable for criminal activities that take place in massage establishments. The cycle of human trafficking remains completely unbroken until the owners are also held legally accountable for the activities of their establishment. So, for all of the reasons that you've heard today already, I urge you to support House Bill 110. It seeks to make reasonable regulatory changes that aims to reduce the burden on therapists, clean up and modernize language from the original licensing bill, and help combat human and sex trafficking. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Do we have any questions of the committee? Seeing no questions, is there anybody else in the room who would like to testify?
It's going to be
anybody online who would like to testify?
I'll be that guy.
And seeing nobody, we will close public testimony on HB 110. And with that, do we have any Representative Wilson and then Kawasaki?
Mr. Chairman, I just have a question on the fiscal note on a comment on the back. The fiscal note, it's going to be paid out of DGF by the committee, but it says the potential number of establishments affected by this bill is unknown at this time. Future costs for legal and hearing service expenses and out years are unknown. I don't think we're changing anything that's going to change the establishments. I've never really seen that language, so we could just.
It's going to be the new duty of the board.
And if you could maybe come up and put yourself on the record and that's go ahead and answer the question.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Janie McCullough. I'm the Division Director for Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. When Representative Wilson, through the chair, when we were looking into this, it is licensing new licensing establishments for massage, and we do not know exactly how many there are statewide it's just an unknown number. We're not talking thousands, but we are talking, a couple hundred. We're just not sure how many there are out there until we start licensing them.
Follow up. And that'll be charged to the establishments. There won't be any UGF, unrestricted general funds, to do anything that's in this bill. Is that correct?
Yes. Representative Wilson, through the chair, that is correct. We are receipt-supported services, and our costs are covered by licensing fees, and so the establishments would be paying a fee.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we're talking about establishments as if they're brick-and-mortar-style establishments. And I just have a question regarding that. What if a person is a massage therapist but comes to the fifth-floor finance room and gives massages to folks on an occasion? Is that going to have to be now a licensed establishment? Or will it – I mean, I just want to make sure that we're not – that's not going to have to become a licensed establishment or an established place. And we're just talking about brick and mortar at this point.
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, that would be brick and mortar establishments, but it would be spelled out through regulation through the board. It would require a definition that would include brick and mortar, I'm sure.
And just to follow up, I guess I better just state my intent for supporting the bill is that we're talking about brick and mortar establishment only, and that we're not getting into this whole issue of, the lighting, is it ADA accessible, things like that for an establishment that might be outside of a brick and mortar establishment for a massage therapist. Thanks.
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, that would best be answered by the board chair.
Thank you, Mr. McCullough. Do we have any further questions while she's here?
I do.
Representative Kawasaki.
Just one really brief question. In a piece of legislation that's already moved from the committee, we put the fingerprinting issue as once every three renewals. In this one, it's once every 6 years, and I know there's biennial licensing. Is there any difference between those two, the way we've worded those two?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, the better language is in HB 110. The other is a little bit more restrictive. The goal is to require fingerprinting approximately every third renewal. Once within 6 years gives us a little bit of flexibility. We intend to make a particular renewal year the renewal year for fingerprinting. I think it will work.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you have any further questions? Representative Seaton?
And just wanting to follow up with Representative Kawasaki's question. So the chair massage, which is mobile and is done in different establishments. That would be up to the board to clarify whether that's an establishment or not an establishment. And I just want to put my intention on here as well, that this is not meant to eliminate the ability of a chair massage to be given by requiring if the board would require that every place a chair massage was going to be given would have to be licensed as an establishment. That would not be within the intent of myself, and I see several other members saying that, just to let the board know that that's not what we intend by that. Thank you.
Moving to the questions. Seeing none, I don't know if there is any intent to do any amendments or if folks felt comfortable and wanted to move forward today. Representative Wilson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think we've discussed this fully when we did the sunset bill. I like to see it move because they need that other member. I think that's one of the biggest reasons they kind of, we heard that from the audit, and then we heard the importance of what it was. And as far as the fiscal notes, it's paid by receipts, as we have heard. And the only thing that the first time that we've heard today is just about the hours, and I would hate to think, as this is sitting here, somebody's taking the same class twice, and they're not free doing that. So if nobody has objection, we do have one question. So are we okay with the effective date being July 1st, 2019? It should be okay, right? Just double checking. With the sponsors, make sure that the effective date, could change them on quite a few. I just want to make sure that July 1st, 2019 is okay.
Ms. Kienemann?
Thank you. Again, for the record, Crystal Kienemann, staff to Representative Keto. Yes, fiscal the effective date is what we intend and what is.
And so, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson?
I'd like to move CS for House Bill number 110-30-LS0157-U with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations from committee.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. And are there any objections? Seeing none, brief at ease. House Finance back on record at 10:55 a.m. So if there are no objections, CS for HB 110, which is 30-LS0157-U, and that is with individual recommendations in the attached fiscal notes, no amendments, is passed out of committee. And so with that, folks could please stay to sign the committee report, and our next meeting will be this afternoon, Thursday, March 1st at 1:30 p.m. And at this meeting, we will take up public testimony for HB 286, which is the operating budget, and also HB 285, the mental health budget. And as follows, folks will have an opportunity to testify from Homer, Kenai, Ketchikan, Kodiak, Matsu, and Seward from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock, from 3:15 to 4:15, folks from Ukiavik, Dillingham, and Fairbanks, and then from 4:15 to 4:45, the off-nets will be open. Public testimony, we want to allow people to, everyone to be able to testify, so we would ask that folks limit their testimony to 2 minutes. And if you are a member of a group with the same message, in the interest of time, we would ask that that group select a spokesperson. If you're calling from a community without a legislative information office, then and if you're an off-net caller, please call only during the designated off-net times on March 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. All off-net callers are required to hang up immediately after your testimony, to keep as many lines open for the other callers. And so one option would be folks could watch on TV if they wanted to follow along with testimony. Testifiers can continue to access the meeting online at www.akleg.gov. Click on Alaska State Legislature and then choose the Live Now button. And the hearing may be televised on gavel to gavel, so please check your local listings. Please do arrive 15 minutes early to expedite the signing process. Please sign in at your LIO about 30 minutes prior to the end of the allotted time period, just in case the testimony closes early if there aren't very many people. If you live in a community with a legislative information office but are unable to access it during the specified time period, you may send your written testimony to the House Finance Committee via housefinance@akleg.gov through 1 p.m. Saturday, March 3rd, 2018. And let's see, just a correction, our meeting is not at 1:30 today. Our public testimony will be starting at 1 p.m. today. So with that, if there is nothing else to come before the committee, we will be adjourned at 10:59 a.m. Thank you.